coming today, and especially to the administration of this worthy college and the students for inviting us. So the topic, spiritual science. Mr. Mufatlal was explaining to you how religion in this world today has a very bad name. In fact, just 1.5 weeks back, I was in Israel, Jerusalem, and my God, I was very, very surprised to see how much hatred, animosity, and sectarianism are amongst people who profess to be most religious. After all, people who are sincere in heart, they want to approach the matter of religion to learn how to love, to learn how to be good to others. So what is the problem? The problem is that people do not understand the science of spirituality. And it is a science, in the sense that all great religions of the world are aimed at one subject matter. Not being a Muslim, a Christian, a Hindu, a Jew, or a Buddhist. But every scripture and every true saint of every great religion teaches what is truth. And truth cannot be different in different places at different times. Truth is a universal principle. What we learn in the colleges today are relative truths, which are very important in our practical everyday lives. How to be a good engineer, or how to be a good mathematician, or computer technologist, or manager, or businessman. But what is the underlying truth? Where I am coming from? Who I am? What is the goal of human life? These truths, unfortunately, in the secular form of education, are being completely neglected, and most of the religious circles, they're being completely perverted in a manner that is utterly egoistic and sectarian. So therefore, the real change of heart from illusion to truth can only come about when we approach the matter as it was originally presented to humanity, and that is as a science. What is consciousness? Who am I? That is the basic, most fundamental teaching of this spiritual science. Every day we are putting on our clothes, we are taking bath, we are combing our hairs, we are looking in mirror, and we are thinking, I look very good today. And we go to school to get certain types of knowledge, most of us, so that we could make a lot of good money, so that we could decorate this body which I call me. But is this superficial approach to life all there is? Or is there something more? Who am I? Most people go through their entire life and they never even once seriously make this inquiry. And if the subject matter comes into their mind, they're afraid to try to understand it. People in our society are trying to run from themselves through so many superficial designations and attaching themselves to those. With the conception that if I become accepted by society and I become successful in my economic pursuits, I will be happy. But where have we ever found this to be true? It is a grand illusion. Coming from America, the illusion is far more grand than here in India. So we have a lot of understanding in this regard. Recently, about 2 years back, I happened to spend about 8 hours sitting and talking with one of the most prominent and well-known popular television and movie actors in all of America, all of the Western world. And he was explaining to me how he has 3 Mercedes. He has an over $1.5 million house in Beverly Hills on a mountain. He has a beautiful young wife. He mixes with all the most famous people in all the world. People who just their name, there's practically, even in the tribes of Africa, they know these people's names. Everyone, if an average person were to know one of these people, they would be telling everyone the rest of their lives, oh, I met so-and-so. He was with them every day, every night, going to their social parties, mixing with them, sometimes having all sorts of intimate relations with them. And he told me, very honestly and very confidentially, that my life is an empty shell. He was a young man in his late 30s, very incredibly strong and healthy, very handsome. He said, I have this body that's so strong, so handsome, I could decorate it any way I want. Beautiful house, beautiful women, beautiful cars, popularity beyond anyone's imagination. But inside, I'm lonely. It's all superficial. I realize that all I'm doing is running from myself, trying to hold on to something that really has nothing to do with me. And in a few years, what is going to happen to all of these things? It's going to be gone. And what's going to be left? I do not even know. I have no idea. Please explain to me, is there hope for such a fallen person as myself who has betrayed the truth? I told him, this is the man that people crowd around wherever he goes just to take their picture with him, to get autograph from him. I told him, I am very pleased because you are very sincere. And he started to cry. He said, really? You really think I'm sincere? Is there actually hope for me? I said, tell me, what about all these other great, great, popular, famous politicians, movie actors, musicians that you mix with and you know intimately? He knows all of them. He says every single one of them is lonely and simply puts on a show day and night trying to look happy and successful. But inside they are all empty shells. He said, I want to understand what is truth. He did not want to give up his occupation, but without truth, our life is meaningless. And as our host was explaining, I give many, many lectures in universities in America. For the past 12 years, at one time I was giving every day 5 to 7 lectures a day, just traveling to universities, and mixing very intimately with the students. And what I found is the greatest tragedy that I could imagine. These young people, as far as I was concerned, they were in spiritual slaughterhouses. Because they were learning everything except what makes a human being good and what makes life meaningful. They were learning how to be frustrated, efficient machines in society. They were not understanding what is within their own heart. Yes, of course, they're superimposing so much data about the modern physical sciences. But what are you going to do with it? That is the problem. Our scientists are so much scrutinizingly analyzing what is the atom and creating atomic energy, which is a wonderful thing in and of itself, but the greatness is what they're going to do with that. Because they haven't understood the truth within their own hearts, they're not using it for constructive but destructive purposes. They're building bombs to destroy innocent women, children. Do you think that is a satisfying way of life? And in medical colleges, I find people who don't care anything for the patients, they only care for the money. And some of the wealthiest doctors who are good friends of mine, they're miserable, they're frustrated. They don't even know what to do with all their money, but they still want more. Do we want to be successful in this shallow, superficial matter? Do our life, is it meant simply to be a hollow shell decorated with all sorts of ornaments in the name of degrees, nice dress, nice prestigious awards from society? Is that what we want? If it is, then there's no need to analyze the subject matter of spiritual science. But if there is something more, if we want to build a foundation of truth in our life and build upon that, then this is one of the most essential subjects to truly apply one's intelligence to understand and build the rest of our life upon that. Mr. Mufetlal is a very, very successful businessman. So much so that most people can't even imagine ever coming to such esteem. Mr. Maheshwari is a very, very skilled and well-known high court advocate here in Bombay. But what they have done is they have built their career, they have built their life on the foundation of truth. And therefore, what they are doing has meaning, purpose. Whatever they do is an expression of the love that is dormant within their hearts. Real pleasure is an expression and reciprocation of love. On the superficial platform, we try to express and exchange love through sex, which is simply the mingling of two bodies. But we don't even really know each other. or the mingling of two minds. But of course, to the degree humanity betrays the principle of spiritual truths, that relationship becomes meaningless. In America, people are famous for being very, very beautiful physically and very intelligent mentally. And the exchanges of love is that 66% of all marriages end in divorce within the first 3 years. What does that mean? Such so-called love without truth is simply frustrating. India is less in its divorce rate, but it's catching up very rapidly to the degree it becomes superficial and leaves behind its own spiritual heritage. And when there's divorce, what does it mean? 95% of the juvenile delinquents who are engaging in crimes in America come from divorced parents. Is this what we want our society to be? If it is, follow in the footsteps of the hollow, materialistic way of life. If it isn't, we have to find a substance and a truth within ourselves and to live for that. To try to connect our consciousness again with that love within us and express that through whatever we do, whether we be engineers or whether we be sannyasis. It is not important what we do. What is important is why we do it and who we do it for. Who am I? Such a simple question. But how many people understand? I'm an Indian or I'm an American. You could change your nationality. Practically every Indian that goes to America changes his nationality and gets a green card. So that means you're neither one. Who am I? I'm a man or I'm a woman. By the grace of biological sciences today, you could change your sex. We have a nice center for Vedic studies in Cleveland, Ohio. And this very, very sincere, apparently sincere girl would come every 2-3 days for about 4 years. And then this girl, she didn't come for another year and a half. One day, we heard a knock on the door, and he was standing there. He was a man, or she was a man. Actually had an operation where an entire biological transformation took place. She had all the organs of a woman. She was clinically a man. So you could change your sex. You could change your family. You could change your caste. You could change the color of your skin. I am not this mind. My mind is changing at every moment. Who am I? I am the consciousness that animates and gives life to this body. To understand the nature of that consciousness within you is truth. Every part of your body is changing. Every part of your mind is changing to some extent. But there is something constant through all the changes, and that is our consciousness. Whether you're a tiny little baby sucking on your thumb, looking at the world through a baby's eyes, or whether you're a student sucking on your pencils, looking at the world through a student's eyes, or whether you're an old man looking at it eyes through all bifocal glasses. You are the same person. Who is it that's seeing? Who is it that's hearing? Who is it that is experiencing the various changes of life? Who am I? There is a science to understand that. And it is a very, very important and valid, and it is a very essential science. Therefore, when we talk of religion, we are not talking about beliefs. We are not talking about, as Mr. Muffet Lau was saying, blind faith. We're not simply talking about particular sets of rituals. We are talking about that science which gives us an understanding and an experience of truth. The underlying truth within us and within all living beings. And that truth harmonizes humanity and all living beings. And without that truth, all so-called harmony is superficial and is doomed to failure. Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Nashito vidyate bhavo na bhavo vidyate shata. Ubhayor api dristantas tvanayo svatadarashabhi. That which is based on truth is eternal, and that which is based not on truth, but on illusion, is temporary. It can have no duration. And that is why all the so-called attempts for peace in this world without educating people in the truths of life are doomed to failure. The United Nations, the League of Nations, has there ever been peace in this world? People are fighting, there's disharmony, because people do not understand what they truly and essentially have in common. Everyone is simply seeing the differences. Because in the relativistic point of view, there are so many differences amongst us. But on the basis of truth, the essence of knowledge, we are one. We are one in spirit, we are one in nature, we are one in God. The body is always changing, the mind is always changing. Who am I? I am that consciousness. What is the nature of that consciousness? That is the topic of spiritual science. It is explained in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Quran, in the Torah, in the New Testament, in the Buddha Sutras, in the Granth Sahib, in all the great spiritual science books of this world, and by all the great and true spiritual teachers throughout history, in all lands, they all explain that the nature of this consciousness is that it is eternal. It is pure. It is full of love, full of compassion, and is part of the supreme consciousness, or God. And to have a basic preliminary understanding of the nature of consciousness is very, very important. Because without which we will not strive to perfect our consciousness. All of you in this college, you must have some basic understanding of the importance of engineering in your life, for your family, and for the world. Otherwise, would you be striving, reading all these books, coming to classes every day for years? You have to be motivated. Philosophy is meant to give a person a scientific understanding and conviction of what way I want my life to direct itself. And then we have to strive in that direction. It is described, and we all experience it in our daily life. When it rains, the water that comes from the sky is crystal clear. And when it comes onto the ground, it becomes full of mud. So my question is, what is the nature of water? The essential nature of water. Is it clear or is it muddy? It's always clear. When it's mixed with other things, then it appears muddy. But in truth, it is always pure. We simply have to separate what is water from what is not water. That is a process of filtration. When we filter water, all of the dirt is in the filter, and the water is again in its clear state, in its pure state. This is a scientific process, is it not? Filtration. It's a simple science, but it is a science. And similarly, philosophically, we can speak in many, many, many elaborate, elegant details in regard to the nature of the soul and the nature of God. But we do not have much time. So we are simplifying it to its most basic form, which is really all we need to know. The rest is just to satisfy our mind. But this is all we need to know. Is our consciousness is by nature eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss, full of joy, full of pleasure. We have all heard of being happy from within, finding peace within. And factually, there's no other place to find peace. In New York City, I have seen on Fifth Avenue people who live in beautiful, beautiful apartments worth sometimes $5-6 million. And they have security guards all around, and they have chauffeurs. But they can't even sleep at night. They're so frustrated. They have to take sleeping pills just to make just some chemical to make them forget the reality of their life. And yet, the society has duped them in such a crazy manner that they think that they're successful and everybody should be like them. Is this what we want? If you find peace within yourself, whether you're a beggar on the street or whether you're the prime minister, you're going to find peace and love everywhere, and you're going to do good for all, according to your capacity. And if you cannot find peace and joy within your own heart, you have nothing really very valuable to share with anybody. People are cutting out of these colleges with all sorts of big, wonderful, fancy degrees, but they're greedy. And they use all of their big education simply to fulfill their greed. And their greed is never satisfied. They're frustrated, and they make a mess out of the society. Is that what we want? That is the question. Our consciousness is by nature eternal, full of knowledge, and full of joy. And in a joyful state, a real joyful state, based on truth, there can be no greed. Real joy only wants to share itself with everyone it comes in contact with. Love simply wants to extend itself to every object it comes in contact with. That is the nature of love. The nature of love is to give. The nature of greed is to take. Real pleasure is in giving the love of our hearts. That love is already in our hearts. But like water, our consciousness is now mixed with so many superficial external designations that we call ourselves, that we are not aware of who we are. But through the process of purification, our consciousness becomes clear. It becomes transparent. And through the transparency of our consciousness, we can perceive through our direct experience God at every moment. And when you perceive that God at every moment, you realize, not that you feel or you believe or you think, but you realize that whether someone calls that God Allah or Jehovah or Yahweh or Krishna or Ram or Buddha, God is the supreme object of love and the source of all that exists. Theory without experience and realization is useless. I was speaking recently to a very, very prestigious PhD who's also a very religious man. And he said, the difference between material science and spiritual science is this. And this man has two PhDs at Cornell University, which is a very, very high college in the US. And he told me that in material sciences, the best that anyone has ever come up with is some intellectual proof of a theory, but no experience of its truth beyond intellectualization. Just like you can prove that if you mix hydrogen with oxygen in different parts, you get water. But until you drink that water, what is the use? Who needs water? Everyone needs water. An intellectual understanding is not enough. You have to drink it. In spiritual science, he said, you can have direct perception and experience of the subject matter at all times. Who am I? We don't want to simply fill your heads with theories. We want to give you a little food for thought, hoping that many of you will be a true and glorious contribution for this society and for this world by purifying your hearts, by experiencing and realizing the truths within you and God within you, and sharing that with the world and finding joy in that. Through being an engineer, through being a housewife, through being a father or a husband, let us build the foundation of our career on truth, on the spiritual science of the purification of our consciousness and the awareness of our relationship with God. And of course, various religions give different methods, but they are all for the same purpose. Many of us are very, very much disgusted with the rituals of religion because people do not understand the science behind it. For a superstitious reason, or because they are afraid that some god will be angry with them, people do their pujas. Not only in India, but everywhere in the world, but especially in India. It is the duty of the scriptures and is the duty of the great sadhus, and everybody could be a sadhu. Anyone who knows the truth and presents the truth is a sadhu. Mr. Maheshwari, Mr. Mafalal, they are sadhus. According to their capacity, they are presenting the truth. And the truth is, what is the science? What is the real intelligent meaning behind all of these rituals? There's nothing wrong with the rituals, except if we don't do it for the proper purpose, with the proper understanding. It's all meaningless. It's as superficial as materialistic life. This is what is needed. I am not so great that I can hope to convince any of you, but I am pleading with you, as the future of India and the future of the world, to really and truly and deeply open your ears, open your minds, and open your hearts to analyze and try to understand the substance of truth. To make a very, very serious study of spiritual science and apply it to your life every day. Within our League of Devotees movement, which is a very ancient spiritual movement, it began with Krishna speaking Bhagavad Gita over 5,000 years ago. And before that, Sanatana Dharma means the eternal message underlying all the great spiritual sciences. But historically, we understand that manifestations of this Sanatana Dharma have come in different forms, in different places throughout history. We are following this teaching, which is coming from the Gita, spoken by Krishna, and which was later on reconfirmed and spread very widely by Lord Chaitanya 500 years ago. And he extracted from the Vedas, and he extracted from all the great spiritual science books of the world, that the chanting of God's name is the most suitable and simple process of purifying or filtering our consciousness and bringing it back to its original natural state. There are many names of God. We are chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hari Hari, Hari Rama, Rama Rama, Hari Hari. This process of filtration through the chanting of God's name is not meant to convert people from one religion to another. It is meant to awaken the dormant truths within our own hearts and live on the basis of that truth. Thank you very much. Is there any questions? If anyone has any questions, we can try to answer your questions. Let me ask you a question. Is there any evidence that man has thought? Can you prove to me that you are thinking now? Can you prove it? Everyone knows you're thinking, but we can't see it with our eyes. We can't hear it with our ears. Because thought is subtler than what the gross senses can perceive. Only a fool will say, because I cannot see it, it's not happening. In fact, most principles that you believe to be true in this world, you have no central experience of. You just accept it on the basis of faith, correct? 99% of what they're teaching you in college, you have no direct experience that it's true. You accept it on faith. What to speak of history? You cannot see a thought. But we can understand by what you do and how you do it, what you must be thinking. Huh? And for you, you are experiencing thought. And we are all experiencing our own thoughts, but not through our gross senses. Through a finer, more refined experience of our own life. Correct? A thought is subtler than touching something or tasting something. Even when you're sleeping, you could think, when all your senses are turned off. So in the same way, we must understand that evidence is not always based on what we can perceive with our senses. When you ask about rebirth, as long as we are completely immersed in the conception that I am this physical body, we can experience nothing beyond it. But those persons who have realized the eternal nature of the soul, they have direct perception of how the soul is at the time of death going from one body to the next. According to its actions and according to its desires, the soul is carried from one body to another body. And if you have the eyes to see, you'll see evidence of it everywhere. But if you don't have the eyes to see, then you will doubt. Therefore, in the scriptures, there is evidence. In the Bhagavatam, in the Bhagavad Gita, in all the great scriptures of the world, in some places, it is explained that the soul is eternal and it is transmigrating from one body to another, to another, to another, according to its karma or desires and activities. And there are even PhD doctors. There's a whole institute in Australia that are simply involved in trying to scientifically, according to Western conception of science, prove the data of reincarnation. And they're not necessarily religious men. They just cannot deny it. People, when they're put in hypnotic trance, they're all of a sudden talking about being someone else from some other place at some other time. And when they do research, they find that person's name in the records, they find the home that they used to live in, the well that they drop water in, all their brothers and sisters, everything intact, and those persons have never even been to that country in their life. This institute in Australia on reincarnation has hundreds of such instances, which is undeniable proof and evidence. How do these people know when they've never been? One lady in Manchester, England, she had never left Manchester, England in her life. But she was talking about her home in Ohio under hypnosis and how her father died when she was six and how her mother raised her and she used to go to a certain well to drink water and who was the president of the United States at the time and all these things. And they went to that place, checked the records, found that well wasn't being used anymore for about 40 years. Everything was in order. And these are scientists who are not even religious. They're just open enough to accept that what is before our eyes, let's try to just not just go like this, like everybody else is doing. Let's try to really understand. From a scientific point of view, they have tens and thousands of pages of proof, documented. But it's simply reconfirming what the scriptures have always said. Krishna says in the Gita, Dehinosmin yatha dehe komaram yovanam jara tatha dehantara praptya dhirastatra namuyate. The embodied soul passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, and similarly at the time of death, the soul passes into another body. It's simple to understand. Do you think, and let's speak logically now, that everything in this creation is happening by chance? Let's speak scientifically. Science is based on logic. Is everything coming from something or is everything coming from nothing? It's a very, very fundamental question. Is there a God or is there not a God? This is the way to answer it. And I'm not going to give you the answer. I'm only going to give you the means by which you can try to analyze it for yourself. Is everything coming from something or is everything coming from nothing? Now, in our scientific investigation and in our practical perception of this world around us, in every case, have we ever found anything coming from nothing? Where do you come from? A father and a mother. Where did they come from, father and mother? Where does this podium come from? A tree. Where does the tree come from? A seed. Where does that seed come from? Another tree. Where does this metal come from? A mine. Have you ever experienced anything coming from nothing? Raise your hand if you have. Has science ever found anything coming from nothing? Now, in science, we have to be consistent with our perception, and that's logical. If something is totally inconsistent with our own perception, it's illogical. It's not real science. So if everything within creation that anyone has ever seen is coming from something, to say that ultimately everything is coming from nothing, is that possible? Is that logical? Is that scientific? Is there any evidence? Is there a shred of evidence that anything could come from nothing? What to speak of the entire universe and the entire creation, which is operating in such an incredibly scientific manner, with the technology of one cell in your body. With the technology of one cell in your body is greater than the best computers ever made by man. Have they just come from nothing? There's no brain behind it? If everything comes from something, that something is the definition of God. You may have many names, but the Brahma Sutra, the essence of Vedic knowledge, explains Janmadhyashajata. God, or the Absolute Truth, is Him from whom everything emanates. That's something. But obviously, that something from which everything emanates is not something ordinary like me or you. It is something much greater. If one of our scientists could make an airplane, that something that we're talking about has floated all of the planets. They never crash. They always remain the same distance from the sun. And on each planet, it's totally self-sufficient. This planet Earth, there's rain, there's oceans, there's land. The sun evaporates the water. It goes into the sky. It becomes a cloud. It falls on the ground. There's little seeds in the ground. It grows. It happens to be the first perfect food for man. Is that an accident? A baby is eating food. Does he know what's happening, how it's being digested? It's happening automatically. Every cell in your body is fighting off diseases like anything. Are you consciously ordering them to do it? You can build a computer, but put two computers alone in a room one night. Could they produce a third one? Could they even turn themselves on without a man? But any two species of life that have been created by that something, they could come together and just without any external help, they could create a third. You see, when we are speaking about the Bhagavad Gita, the Quran, the Torah, the Granth Sahib, we are speaking of the message coming from that something. And when the message coming from that something is explaining life after death, it has a very, very deep scientific analysis. Bhagavad Gita deals with this subject very, very deeply. And it's speaking about something that is beyond our power of comprehension. In the sense, we can understand it when it is revealed to us, but we can never figure these things out. It is beyond our intelligence. Certain things we must accept are beyond us, that we have to accept. These scientists who have undisputable facts for anybody who has a liberal mind of reincarnation, they cannot explain where everything's coming from, where the soul that's reincarnating is coming from, but they understand that the soul is reincarnating, and that's scientific, and no one can argue about it if they look at the data. The only argument they can come up with is that these men are simply cheating. But they have signed documents everywhere. And there's a team of them. There's no question of that. Now, these men, what they want to do now is now they're becoming very, very religious afterward. Now they want to, we understand the soul is transmigrating. There's a consciousness, there's an awareness that's going from one body to another to another. Now, they can't figure out what the nature of that soul is. They have to come to the spiritual science books and the spiritual scientists to understand those subject matters. Is there any other questions? Materialistic approach, you said? For poor people. What is the definition of rich and poor? That is the question. If someone is poor in heart, they're really poor. They're really suffering. If someone is simply poor physically, they're not really suffering as much. 90% of the suicides in this world are not from the poor people. They're the rich people who have everything, who are still frustrated, who can't even face life. They're poor. Huh? It is true that people need food for their body, but they also need food for their minds and they need food for their souls. Why do we separate them? We should not stop feeding our bodies. Eating feeds your body. Coming to college feeds your mind. We shouldn't stop these things. But why should we starve our souls? That is the problem. Everyone, rich or poor, needs, in order to be happy and fulfilled in life, they need food for the body, the mind, and the soul. I was recently with Mother Teresa, and who knows more about feeding hungry people than her? Huh? She has a lot of experience. She's 83 years old. She's been doing it for the past 50, 60 years, just feeding poor people, people who are destitute. And when I talked to her, she said the real hunger in this world is not amongst the poor people, but the rich people. Because it's simple. Anyone can give a chapati and fill a man's stomach. But people's hearts are starving. They're lonely. They're unfulfilled. Their lives are meaningless. And the rich people are worse off than the poor people in spiritual starvation. Starvation of the heart. Loneliness. To feed them with God's love, that is the true and topmost necessity in this world. If you have a material problem, work hard. Solve it. Feed your family, clothe your family, give shelter to your family. That you must, it's your duty. But the ignorance of humanity is they want to disregard the prime responsibilities to give all of their energy to the subordinate responsibilities. We must tend to all of our responsibilities in life. Why should we be so narrow-minded? just like, do you have responsibilities to follow the laws of this college as long as you're here? Yes. Does that mean as soon as you leave the college, you can break the laws of the state? You're just as responsible for the laws of the state as you are for the laws of the college. And you're also responsible to be a good son for your parents, are you not? You have so many responsibilities. Does it mean because I'm following one, I reject the others? It's craziness. We need food for the body, the mind, and the soul. We are responsible to nourish our body, our mind, and our soul, whether we're rich or poor. That is the great need. And we must serve those needs. So it is true that poor people need food. They need clothing. They need shelter. But they also need a feeling of worth in their life, a feeling of dignity before God. And they also need joy and happiness and love. And that will only come through physical, mental, and spiritual progress. And besides that, what people of the world are really and truly reaching out to these people? Not the social welfare institutions. I've been all over the world. I know what's going on to some extent. I worked with the social welfare institutions in America. They're just doing it for money. Professionals paid to give, to allocate certain welfare services to the poor, but practically they don't even know what the poor, how they're suffering or why. It's a profession. And nobody really benefits. They keep in storage millions and millions and millions of pounds of butter and flour and all kinds of staple foods. And when you're honestly asking no money, you just want to go into the deepest, darkest, poorest ghettos and distribute these food, they won't give it to you. They'll spend the taxpayers' money by the millions every year to store it. But they won't give it to you. Why? Because if you give it to too many poor people, then the prices go down in the stores. And then the rich people don't make as much. And if they did that, they would lose their jobs. They don't care about poor, they care about their own jobs. Who are the people who are truly and really striving to help the poor? People who love God. People who love God and love all God's creations and see that every living being is my brothers and sisters, and it is my responsibility to take care of them if I have what they need. Huh? Does that answer your question? Yes? This is a good question, but it's not as simple as you think. Because wherever there's life, that is the symptom of the presence of the soul. Every blade of grass has a soul. Every tree, every insect, every fish, every animal, every bird in the sky. Wherever there's consciousness, whether it's developed or undeveloped, that is the presence of the soul. And you see, in the lower species, all the souls are coming upward toward the human species. The human species of life is the junction. It's the form of life where the consciousness, the soul, has independence to make its own choices. The lower animals cannot make its own choices. You never see a cow attacking a goat and eating it. Cow eats grass. You never see a tiger eating grass. They eat the goat. The animals, the lower species, they simply act according to the particular instinct of that particular form of life. But a human being can be a vegetarian or a meat eater, could be a criminal or a philanthropist, could be an engineer or a doctor. You have so many choices in your life. What is the reason why God has given the human being such choice? To use this power of discrimination to ask the most essential questions of life. Who am I? Where am I coming from? Where am I going? What is truth? What is the meaning of this existence? When we utilize it for this purpose, then the human being returns, or the soul returns to its original natural position on a spiritual level, on an eternal level of consciousness. Now all the lower levels are coming up. It's just like in a college, if all the lower grades are coming up to the senior year, but none of the seniors graduate, what happens? You have a population explosion in the senior class. So all the lower species are coming up to the human form, but practically no human beings are utilizing their life to graduate and understand what is beyond birth and death. They're simply living with the same basic purpose of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending as the lower species. So it's not that more souls are being created. It is just that many are coming up and coming up and coming up, and nobody's graduating from this senior class of human life. Can you exist without your clothes? Can you exist without driving in an automobile? The body is like an automobile or a set of clothes. It has a function. But we are not dependent, the soul is not depending at all on it. After all, when the automobile gets old, you trade it in. When your clothes get old, you put on new clothes. But you are not dependent on any of these things. The soul is self-sufficient in its relationship with the Supreme Soul or God. But these bodies are very valuable because there is so much we could do in the service of God through these bodies. We should not neglect them. And your education is very valuable because there's so much you can do in the service of God through being well educated. And your profession is most valuable because there's so much you could do in the service of God, in the service of humanity, in the service of your loved ones through the means of your profession. My profession may be a Swami. Mr. Muffatlal's profession is a businessman. Mr. Maheshwari, a lawyer. Your profession is a professor. Other professions may be students at this time, perhaps engineers in the future. Whatever, this society needs all these different professions. Last year I was giving a class in a college of accountants, and everyone was studying accounting. And after giving a talk, one of the accountant students was very challenging. He was actually quite angry. And he raised his voice and said, all this that you're talking about has no relevancy in our life. Because the final, when all things are said and done, what happens if we all accept your philosophy and we all become swamis like you? Who's going to grow the food? Who's going to heal the sick? Who's going to transport the trade? And everybody in the class was going, now everything has come to the conclusion. So I said, in reply, my friend, I'm not going to argue with you, but I'm going to answer your question with another question. What would happen if everyone in the world became an accountant like you? Who would grow the food? Who would heal the sick? Plus, everyone would be unemployed because there'd be nobody to account for. Everyone would know accounting. There's a need for all classes of men within the society. There's a need for farmers. There's a need for engineers. Such a grave need. Beautiful houses, beautiful buildings, beautiful temples. Beautiful hospitals. There's a need for architects. There's a need for businessmen. Unfortunately, in today's society, probably the greatest need there is for lawyers. Because whatever you do, you have to have a lawyer these days, otherwise you're finished. There's a need for every level of society. There's a need for mothers and housewives. There's a need for students. There's also a need for swamis. If we all understand the truth within ourselves and the goal and meaning of life, then we can all work together harmoniously in pursuance of that truth. We can all work together, serving the different functions necessary within our society in harmony, as an expression of love. Love for one another, love for the poor, love for the rich, love for God. Any other questions?
Yes. On one side we are saying that we should not kill any animals, but in Ramayana it is written that Lord Rama went out for killing deer for his wife just for the reason it was looking nice. How we can justify it?
That's a very nice question. But if you actually study Ramayana carefully, Sita didn't want the deer killed. She wanted it captured to keep as a pet. So when they came back to Ayodhya, they would have this beautiful deer as a pet. So he was just going after the deer to capture it, to take nice care of it. It was after the deer manifested itself, after he understood that this deer is actually a rakshasa demon, then he decided to kill it. Yes. Is it a sin to take knowledge? You know, we can throw around this word sin in so many ways and condemn people for what they do on the basis of sin. But let us, in a sensitive and intelligent way, just try to understand what it is that is not conducive to the positive progress of our consciousness by eating non-veg. Part of the problem in this world is selfishness. It's a great problem. No one is thinking in terms of others. The golden rule is do unto others as you would like them to do to you. Correct? Why is it if it is not necessary, should we cause a brutal torture and death to an innocent, life-loving creature just because we like the taste of its flesh? Why? There's so many beautiful fruits, vegetables, grains, dairy products, nuts. That is true. Some of them are. Fruit, you're not killing the tree, you're just cutting it. Practically all vegetables and nuts, you're not killing the thing. You're just giving it like a haircut. Even grains, you just cut it, it grows back. There are certain plant forms that are killed in the process of eating. But those plant forms, the consciousness in that particular form is of such a state that you're not really causing much pain to it. Because they don't have the brain, they don't have the nervous system where they could really experience much. So therefore, you're minimizing violence as far as possible. But if you see a cow or a sheep being killed, there's not much difference between killing a human being. The blood flows, they scream for their life, they run for their life. Huh? They love their children in the same basic way that we love ours. Did you ever see a cow when the calf is hurt? She'll lick the calf, she'll cry for the calf. She cares about that calf. Even a lion will protect its cubs. Besides advanced intelligence, they have all the instincts of life that we have, all the loves and fears that we have. In America, everyone has a pet. And usually they like the pet more than anybody else in the family because the pet never argues with them or fights with them. They're nice. Huh? When I was young, in my family, there was a dog, a pet dog. And the dog was the most popular person in the family because he was the only one everyone got along with. And not only my family, but every family I knew, their pet was the most popular. They loved their pet. If someone came in and chopped off the head of my dog, that would be like chopping off the head of your own family member. The dog licks you, you feed it, it reciprocates. What to speak of a cow? They're giving their milk. They're friendly, peaceful, loving animals, love their children. Huh? Is it necessary that we cause such unnecessary violence, bloodshed, and pain to life-living creatures? If it is necessary, then we should do it. But if it's not necessary, then according to the Gita and the Bhagavad, it is sinful to cause unnecessary pain and death to an innocent creature of God. And it's factually more natural and healthy to eat a nonviolent diet. George Bernard Shaw, one of the most famous of all playwrights from England, he explained that you go to church every Sunday to pray for peace, and then you come home and gorge yourself on dead corpses. He wrote this to the Christians of England, his own people. And Leonardo da Vinci, the most famous artist and inventor from Italy, he said, he who kills people when people become sensitive and sane in society, they will understand that eating meat is murder. This is what many sensitive, sincere thinkers have considered and concluded. There's no need. If there is a need, do it. But if there's no need, be godly. Be compassionate. Be loving. Yes?
Why don't you say that Lord Krishna also
Mr. Muffatlal is married, Mr. Maheshwari is married, they are married. In our congregation, I would say 97-98% of the devotees are married. Why do we not marry? For one reason. Because although Krishna himself married, in other incarnations he didn't marry. But Krishna has a... We can't imitate Krishna. We have to follow his instructions. In the Gita, Krishna explains, Chaturvarna mayastristam guna karavam bhagish. He says he has established
different orders of life. And there is a necessity for each of these orders of life. Just like I was explaining, we need accountants, we need engineers, we need lawyers and businessmen and farmers. There is also a need for people who dedicate their entire lives to uplifting and enlightening others. And it's very difficult for someone to do that when they have a family, because it practically takes all of their time just to maintain their family in God's service. What to speak of the brother? Just like Mother Teresa, if she had a husband and children, she would be the mother of maybe 5 or 6. And would she have time for everybody else? But because she chose that path of not marrying in the service of humanity, she could be the mother for thousands. Huh? In my own life, wherever I go in the world, I'm free to travel anywhere and everywhere and give my full time to try, according to my small capacity, to uplift people spiritually, which is a need in society. But if I would marry, how much time would I have to do that? So there is a great need for people to raise their own children in God consciousness. But there's also a great need for sannyasis and brahmacharis to elevate the consciousness of those grihasthas so that they have the proper understanding of how to raise their children in God consciousness. They're all interrelated. There's a need for both. Why we don't marry? So we can give more time for people like you. Huh? Let me ask you, why is it that most students don't want to marry till after they graduate? How many of you are married in here? Not the professors, but the students. How many of the students are married? Raise your hands. Let me ask another question, and please don't ignore me because you'll make me feel very useless if you do. Raise your hand if you have plans on getting married after you graduate. So you're all going to be sannyasis like me? Raise your hand if you plan on getting married. Everyone. If you're not, I'm going to be watching you very closely. I might be sending you some letters and invitations too. You're not married now. Why? Because you want to put your full energy in your studies. Huh? You can. Huh? What? But it's a disturbance. Because you have, in this particular time of your life, you want to dedicate every bit of your energy to your studies. And if you get married, you have to get a job. Whether you're educated or uneducated, you have to work. You have to be practical. You have to feed your children. You have to feed your wife. You have to pay your rent. Right? You can't study anymore. Now, after you get your studies completed, to marry, to raise your family, especially if it is in unification with truth, in God's service, that's a glorious service to God and the world. But at this particular time, you understand that you need full attention. So what is the purpose of a swami or a brahmachari? To give full attention to enlightening others, mostly those who are married, so that they could have someone to look up to and someone to always be at hand, ready to help them. Usually married people, when they need somebody to help them, it's very hard to get another one because they're busy. Just like Devamrita Prabhu, he comes to this college. He goes to different colleges every day, not trying to convert people, but trying to enlighten the youth of India to live for truth, to live in love. If he had wife and children, he couldn't do this all day just educating people in this way. So there's a need for all these different classes, for sannyasis, for brahmacharis, for grihastas, for vanaprastas. And when they all work together in truth and in love, then the society becomes truly productive and truly beautiful. And our lives become truly productive and truly beautiful. Yes. Did you hear? Yes, we can say that it's God's grace. Because why is it God's grace? Because what I am speaking is not my opinion. What I am speaking, I am only coming like a mailman, like a messenger, like a courier, with the message of God. I am not God. I am just a very small man. I have many limitations. But the message that I am speaking is infinite. It is great. It is unlimited, because it is the message of truth. It is the message of Sanatana Dharma, as it has been spoken by Krishna in the Gita, and as it has been spoken by all the great prophets. And this message is the grace of God. Huh?
So we are like computers, is being handled by one God.
By one God? Does God give you freedom? God gives you freedom. If God didn't give you freedom, if God simply programmed you to love Him, you would be a computer. But God gives you the freedom to love Him, or love anybody else, or hate Him, or betray Him, or rebel against Him. You have the freedom to do whatever you want. You could go out and be a murderer right after this class. Right? You could go to a movie. You could go to the temple. You could dance. You could get drunk. Do you have the freedom to do any of these things? Does a computer have that freedom? A computer has no freedom. A computer simply is programmed to do exactly what the computer operator wants. God does not want to live with computers. He wants to live with people. And therefore, He has given you freedom and independence. You can choose to hear this word, or you can choose to reject this message. We are speaking from our freedom, but our freedom is whether we want to accept or whether we want to accept or reject the grace of God as it is coming through the word of truth. The word of truth is universal. It is not the monopoly of one religion or one person. It is the essence. Huh? What is the law of thermodynamics? Huh? What did he say? According to the law of thermodynamics, for every action there is an equal corresponding reaction. It is also said that there's no such thing as death. Everything is just a transformation of energy. I can't hear you so well. Yes. You see, we were explaining before this question, Does everything come from something, or does everything come from nothing? If everything comes from something, we must understand that that something is different than ourselves. That something is a chintya shakti, has inconceivable potencies beyond our comprehension. Huh? Relative truth means that each truth is interdependent on a previous truth to exist. Why do we call our family members our relatives? Did you ever ask that question? Because we are relative to one another. My father is my relative because my existence is relative to his existence. And his existence is relative to his father's existence. We are all relative to one another. That means we are all interdependent on one another for each other's existence. That is a relative truth. Now, the source of all relative truths cannot be a relative truth, but it is the absolute truth. So either ultimately everything comes from nothing, or everything comes from the absolute truth. Everything cannot come from another relative truth. And if we accept that everything coming from an absolute truth is more logical and scientifically consistent with our perception than everything coming from nothing, then we have to understand by studying the science of the absolute truth. And there is this great science. The Bhagavad Gita, for instance, right here in your land of India, is the study of the absolute truth, very scientifically presented by the absolute truth himself. And when we come to the level of absolute, there is no beginning and no end, because it's the source of all relativity, and it is transcendent or beyond relativity. Is there any other questions? Yes. Luck, fate. What do we mean by fate? Man is the maker of his own destiny or fate. For every action is an equal reaction. We have the choice of what action we perform. But after we perform it, we have no choice what the reaction will be. The reaction is our fate. But we created it. Just like, for instance, if I go to the top of a building and I jump, while I'm in the air, what is my fate? Huh? To hit the ground and die, right? It's my fate. I can't change my fate once I'm in midair. But if I didn't jump, I wouldn't have that fate. If I take poison, what is my fate? To die. I cannot escape from my fate. But if I didn't take the poison, I wouldn't have that fate. If you have intercourse with a woman who you're not married to and she becomes pregnant, what is the fate? You're in trouble, man. There's going to either be a baby or a murder. But if you didn't do that, you wouldn't have that fate. If I go to Sahar Airport and get on an Air India flight to London, and 1 hour after the flight takes off, I say, I do not want to go to London. What will they say to me? It's your fate to go to London because you're on this plane. There's no way that you cannot go to London. But if you didn't get on this, but you had the choice to get on or not, right? Once we perform an act, it is the law of nature that there will be a reaction for every act we make. That is our fate. But we have the choice of what acts that we do. If we do good things, our fate would be good. If we do bad things, our fate will be bad. Destiny is unavoidable after you make your move, after you make your decision. But you have the full spectrum of choice to educate yourself and understand what is the best decision to make in life. And then your fate will be the most auspicious, the most glorious. Huh? Yes. See, when we speak of the laws of karma, or the laws of action and reaction, you cannot judge or understand everything in its face value, how it appears now. Because you have also done a lot of things in the past in this life, and a lot of things in previous lives, and they are all influencing your particular fate. Immediately we can do the same thing and we can get two different results. But what is the background? Have we done the same thing throughout history of our lives? No. Two people come with the same, give the same medicine. One lives and one dies. We must understand that the laws of karma are very intricate. The laws of karma, the law of action and reaction, which is a law of nature, and nature is God's, it takes into consideration every detail of what we are doing and what we have done. And that determines our destiny. Much cheaper, and there's much less pressures. Why do you read books? Why do you have teachers? Because to hear from those books and those people who know gives us access to what we do not know and what would be very, very difficult or perhaps impossible for us to figure out ourselves, right? You're all going to engineering college. Why don't you just figure out engineering for yourself? Forget the books and forget the teachers. Huh? Because that would be practically impossible. Every great spiritual person